Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. I am incredibly excited for today's episode. I'm sitting down with Benny Crook, who is the host of ED Jam, which is a fantastic podcast relating to ED nurses or nurses in general, paramedics, physicians who are really interested in sort of that pre-hospital, but also the emergency medicine side of things. So fantastic resource. I've been binge listening, for quite some time now, and I'm absolutely loving it. And Benny is the clinical nurse educator for a hospital down in Sydney. And so you are a wealth of knowledge, Benny. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm really excited. Do you want to introduce yourself just a little bit more and I guess what got you into nursing and what got you into doing a podcast? Thank you.
Sure. Oh, I feel like my head's so big now I can't walk out of the room. That was heavy. Sorry. I get a bit, that's sort of flattering. Thank you so much. So I'm Benny Crook. I run a podcast on the side, called EDGM, which I love. For me, I actually did sports science at uni. I was super interested. I sort of thought I wanted to be a physiotherapist. And then my younger sister had started an orphanage over in Africa. So I went over there and I was sort of just a bit, I think, shocked by just like what I saw. And I was a bit like, oh, what can I do to help people? Because I love helping people and interacting with people. And I sort of, there was a little medical center there and I just sort of jumped in and sort of helped out. And actually there was a little orphanage there where we just would feed little orphan kids, little tiny babies. And that was a bit like, it was actually kids that got me fired up. I was like, wow, I could really help people. And that was sort of like the starting point. So as soon as I landed back home, I'd enrolled into, physiotherapy at sort of Sydney, and just felt so moved by it that I applied to do nursing as a sort of a mature-ish age student, go straight back to uni and study again. For 2 years. So that was sort of my journey in nursing. And then I did one of my first placements in emergency. I'm like, this is me being quite highly energetic. I was like, I need to do something that sort of like fires me up. And it still used all that anatomy and physiology that I did really well at uni. So that's sort of, that's me. And that's sort of why I sort of got into nursing. The podcast, I'm a talker. I love chatting, but I listen to a lot of like MCRIT podcasts and a lot of American stuff, and I really loved it. But I also felt like I really wanted to have a podcast where I highlighted the amazing people in emergency, such as paramedics, nurses, and doctors, and allied health. And so I was like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to actually talk to Australian people that worked in the medical field? And you know, you could be driving to work and be like, oh, cool. Let's talk about paracetamol overdoses, for example. I had one last week. Maybe I'll have a listen and maybe I can learn something that will help my patient. So for me, it's always about trying to help people, not just the clinician, but also the patient laying in the bed that maybe you could learn something and give the, you know, just that's sort of me. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's actually really cool. And particularly when you said with the orphanage as well, have you ever gone back now that you are, you know, a fully registered and full-fledged nurse?
Yeah, I went back. I've been 3 times now back to Africa, and kids sort of came along. So I've got like 3 kids now, so it's a bit harder. But the plan is when they're a little bit older to head back again. I still have connections with overseas, a lot of friends that still, you know, do that sort of stuff. And there's a lot of people that work in nursing or paramedicine that seem to sort of do that sort of humanitarian stuff, which is epic. I got a friend who recently came back from Ukraine for a month. So really cool stuff that like you can really, it's got to be the right time, if that makes sense. But yeah, I've been back since, but not when I'm fully registered. So I'm super keen to get back there, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Now that's really incredible because we talk to a lot of people on this podcast who, you know, have set up, you know, humanitarian businesses for paramedics, nurses, doctors, like full on medical deployments. So that's been absolutely incredible talking to them. And I feel like when you talk about having a why, you know, a reason why and a strong why for what you're doing and why you're doing it is really important, particularly when things get tough, and they can get tough, particularly in emergency medicine and healthcare in general. So, no, I absolutely love that you had that why quite early on and it changed your career path, which is pretty cool. So, yeah, that's awesome. But,
yeah, kind of, I think you do have those shifts in your career, or even as a person, you might have that one conversation. And I've had them, you still have them later. Like you still have that one, maybe that one click, but you still have other ones along the track. Like, I mean, even in the last couple of years, I had that same again. I thought I wanted to pursue getting into medicine. And so I studied super hard for GAMSAT, but devoted 2 years of my life to try and get in, you know, and didn't get an interview in Sydney. And so we just sort of, and then sort of started looking at it and I was like, oh, is it what I want to do? It's just, you know, do you get what I mean? Like you can still keep evolving and pushing yourself further. And, you know, for me, it was like also about, you know, being present as a person as well. So I think, you know, I pulled a pin on that, but in the same token, it doesn't stop me driving for other things to be successful in.
Absolutely. And in, you know, healthcare in general, there is no sort of limit you can put on yourself in terms of learning anyway. Like there's nothing stopping you from learning the things you would learn in medicine, for example, or the questions that you may want to learn more about to ask your patients for assessments. Like there is no limit. And I think that's the beauty about whatever you're doing in medicine in general, like healthcare in general. So that's really interesting. And I love how you said, yeah, you can have those changes at any point. And being open to those changes is really important as well. So
yeah,
I guess then what's kind of gotten you into now sort of the educational side of things in terms of nursing now?
Yeah, well, I worked at the university as a lecturer as well, teaching. And that sort of was a bit of a, I traveled around Australia when I first got married and I was like, oh, I'm loving working in ED. I worked in a, you know, a level one trauma center. I loved working in it. But I also loved when I got a student in and I was like, oh, do you know how to do this? And I'd be like, oh no, no one's ever shown me. And so I just sort of was like, oh, cool. I kind of felt okay to sort of explain how I did something. And I was like, oh, you know, this is how I do it. You don't have to do it this way, but this is what you do. And I sort of resonated, a couple of students sort of liked that. I could see, you know, from their body language or just the way they were asking questions. And then I was like, oh, maybe I should teach some people like things. So I was like, okay, I'll go to uni. So I was a lecturer for like 5 years. And I think that sort of drove me a little bit. I always stayed clinical during that process. So I still worked in emergency 3 days a week or 4 days a week and then just would work on top of it or even full time and then would work 2 days a week lecturing. I just think when you're a busy person like me, you kind of got to fit a lot in. And that kind of drove me a bit to do the teaching. And I'm a very curious person. I'm not happy with just like, oh, this is just what we do now. It's not my style. I really want to try out new things. I'll make mistakes all the time, but that's how I learn. So I get a bit curious about sort of like, oh, so why do you do that? I constantly ask physicians all the time, why are we doing this? It's just my style of learning. And I think that's what motivated me to sort of go into the teaching side of things.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think if you're a teacher, you're always a student. Mm. So if you actually are a true teacher or a true educator, you're always the learner. And I always am the learner. Like, I mean, even yesterday we had a kid in with, you know, a quadriplegic cerebral palsy who needed a port access. And I'd accessed one before and a little kid before, but mainly adults. And so just even just approaching that kid differently with someone else who'd done it before, I'm the educator, but I'm okay to ask, hey, can you, you know, and the nurse did it and I supported her and helped her do it, but she did it. And so then the next one I'll do on a little kid. And, you know, just I think that's the process of it, in learning. Yeah.
Absolutely. I resonate highly with that in terms of being really curious, but absolutely understanding why you're doing what you're doing is really important. Like we talked about having a why for, you know, why you're going into this career and having a strong one to get you through those tough times. But actually understanding the reasons behind what you're learning is really important. I think having that context, but and I guess that's the reason why you've probably started your podcast and equally mine as well, because you never kind of get, I guess, bored of extra information. And so, as you said there, like you're always going to be a learner. It doesn't matter where you are in your career, whether you're day one, you know, third year student or, you know, 20 years into the job, there's always something to learn, which 100%. Is incredibly humbling.
Yeah. And you learn off, you can learn off anybody. Like, I think the problem is that we just sort of think that if you're an educator, you're the teacher, which is a total whacked way to look at it. Like, I learn sometimes more from the students than I can from some senior nurses or even doctors, because they won't share their information. And I think that's really key, is if you want to teach people, then you have to be willing to sort of not blurt out everything, but at least go, oh, this is what I'm thinking with this patient, or this is what I think could be going on. You can be so wrong. Like, I'll pull up an x-ray and go, I think that's it. Report's back normal, you know? And I'm like, oh, maybe that's just, you know? So then I'll go back and go, hey, I've seen this on the x-ray. What do you think it is? Oh, it's just a, you know, calcification. It's normal. Okay, cool. So, like, you get what I mean? You're sort of stepping up along the journey, and you're not happy to sort of be stagnant and just be like, okay, cool. I don't know that. It's like, we'll go and learn it. That's just me. Yeah,
exactly. It's pushing ego aside when it comes to learning and being like that too cool for school type thing.
Because there are some people that are like that. And you know them, hey, like in paramedicine, they're visible. In nursing, they're visible. In medicine, they're very visible. And also, I think you got to be mindful of the people that also don't know, but say they know the answers, and they're the people that you should avoid as well. The ones that just, yeah, it's this, it's this, it's this. And then you should, as a curious person, look it up. Actually go, well, is that correct? Like, is, you know, if I give this dose of fentanyl, is it the same as that dose of morphine? Don't be happy to go, oh, well, John said, or, you know, Amanda said, this is it. You go, no, well, I'm just going to look it up. Like, is that actually correct? That's just how I sort of approach it. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I guess we'll kick into it too. In terms of ED, you know, a lot of our listeners are student paramedics, and not all of them are doing a dual degree in nursing, so they don't have that understanding. And I think having that understanding as a student for myself, when I was doing both nursing and paramedicine, I kind of took that for granted, and having the, I guess, the knowledge of what nursing is and the role of a nurse, and sort of how working only a few months in ED this year, you know, actually sort of seeing what that is and what that is like is very beneficial as a paramedic, then, to be able to talk to your patients about what's going to happen to them, sort of understand what their patient journey is like, and sort of be able to advocate for them a bit more and understand sort of what's going to happen to that patient. So I think I'd love to pick your brain, because obviously you've been in ED for a very long time, and you know, this is something that you're really passionate about. But I'd love to talk to you a bit more about sort of that role of an ED nurse, particularly for our students or our graduates or anyone listening to this who doesn't know what that is.
Yeah, cool, for sure. I think the role of an ED nurse can be very diverse. Understanding that every emergency department would operate in a different way, and nurses can work in multiple different areas throughout the ED. And I think that's really important to know first, that the nurse you see, you might not know what level of training they're at. Unlike paramedics, in terms of, you might see on their lapel a different color, or you might see a different star, which could indicate, you know, an ICP, or indicate an educator in, or an, you know, SO or something like that. So that's really important to understand. What's important to understand about ED nurses, they've got a set personality, which I think paramedics resonate well with, a dark sense of humor. But I guess the role of the ED nurse would depend on the first person you sort of meet. So often as paramedics, you'll bring a patient into an ambulance bay, and often you're met by a triage nurse, and they've done a fair bit of training throughout the emergency department, often 2 to 3 years of training in the ED. And specifically their role is to triage the patient and give them a category from 1 to 5. And you'll know the cat ones, because you guys will be taking them straight through to resus. But the others, maybe not. They might be sitting in your ambulance bay. And the role of that ED nurse, I guess the triage, if I can talk there first, because that's probably the first person you meet, is kind of to identify if they are really concerned with the patient. And I'll talk to you about the do's and don'ts of triage nurses, because I think there's a lot of mistakes that triage nurses make in their interactions, not just their assessments. And so their job basically is they should listen, and I'll keep that off as the first word, because you guys know the patient better than we do. Let's be honest. I haven't been to their house. I haven't been to the car accident. I haven't been to them falling over in the shower. I haven't been to the domestic violence, or I haven't been to the kid that's fallen over at soccer. So their main role, first of all, should be to listen. But they are on a time a limit, if that makes sense. So they've got to triage patients. Generally, it's like 3 to 5 minutes. So that's really important, is also for you guys to make a succinct story so that the triage nurse can triage them, because there are other patients that you can't see out in the in other areas of the ED. I guess that's the first thing. The second thing is it depends on where that patient would go through their journey, and that emergency nurse will have different sort of skills. So we often, in a mixed emergency departments, we'll have pediatrics. In single systems, so like a pediatric emergency department, then it'll be all pediatrics. And you often have like a resus bay, an acute bay, where you generally get most of your patients run through, a fast track area, which can sometimes turn to slow track. And then often a short stay unit where patients may have a diagnosis. They want to send them home, but there's a few things pending. They might be not safe to send them home, or patients that get admitted and go upstairs. So that's just sort of the journey of that triage nurse. And then often they would quickly type a few things, and then they'd send you guys or call their NUM, which would be the nurse unit manager who is in charge of the whole ED, and put the patient in the most appropriate area. I guess the role of an ED nurse at the bedside is to make an assessment from A to G, like you guys would do. Often initiating things like ECGs, blood tests, x-rays, and performing, you know, giving medications, those sort of things, and communicating with patients and their families. It can be quite hectic in those acute areas, and often, you know, you can have three nurses with like 14 patients, or two nurses at times with 14 patients. So the nurse at the bedside can be quite overwhelmed, and it's really important to understand that sometimes they're not fobbing you off if you're bringing a patient from triage to one of the beds. That can be sort of something to be mindful of. They've probably just got a lot going on in their mind. Yeah, hopefully that covers what they do. And we do other things like cannulate, you know, catheterize, accessing ports. We get complex patients through EDs who could have complex management plans, accessing PEG tubes, accessing central lines. So we do get a range. And at the moment, because EDs are so busy, we're seeing a range of complex patients come through our department. Yeah, so that's just what we would kind of do day to day. The resus nurse is a little different. Their training's a bit different. They have a lot more skills in terms of ventilation, a lot more skills in terms of interpreting blood gases, looking at x-rays, performing multiple different skills as well from a resus nurse as well. And they generally will have a role in that resus team, which sometimes goes well, or it can go horribly poorly as well. Yeah.
Awesome. And I think we'll start off with the triage nurse, because generally that is, you know, the first point of call when you come to the ED, bring a patient in. And when it comes to information they are seeking from the paramedic to be able to make that decision, what's the best sort of or succinct sort of way in which you can provide that information or the pertinent points that they need to know?
Yeah, I think what is important is to follow, like you guys do really well with your IMIS sort of handovers. I think keeping that structure is really helpful. What can happen, in my opinion, is especially if you become familiar in a place, is that you just sort of like you become too cash. So what happens is you roll in your normal personality into the handover, and then what you do is you just don't give all the information. And I had one last week. A guy brought a patient in, and the guy had come in with neck pain, but the patient, the way that he sort of said it was like, oh, this is John. You should know John. So he's assuming that I know John, which I don't. You should know John. He's a regular. He's just complaining of, he's just got pain everywhere. Mm. And then fobbed off that he's got dementia. But anyway, when I assessed the patient, he was GCS 15. He could actually tell me what happened. He said he had an onset of neck pain after a fall. So I think it's really important to sort of like make sure that you're not sort of becoming too casual, but also just keeping a bit of that professionality and just following that IMIS sort of handover. What the triage nurse wants to know in a nutshell is why they've come to hospital, you know, in a nutshell, not the 10 reasons. Give us the one reason why you think they're here, which you guys will be able to ascertain from your drive. Obviously what you've found or what you've done for the patient, which is always important. Always important if you've seen changes in any of their observations or that you're concerned about. And then also I say is like, you know, what you're seeing at the triage, like there and then now, because they can say, oh, they're hypoxic, you know, like sometimes you guys fix them, which is super important. Like we got a septic patient in, they were hypoxic on scene. They were, you know, hypertensive on scene. You guys are giving them fluid, you give them oxygen, like an APO, Lasix or something, and they come in and you fix them. That's important for me to remember that, oh, they weren't very well. And what I'm looking at is a different picture to what you guys saw. And also communicating, the triage nurse should actually look at the patient as well in their assessment skills. We do trust the clinician, but you, it's important to know for the paramedics that, like, often when there's an RCA, which is like a review of a death in ED, or, you know, the triage nurse always gets pulled in every time. So every single time. So yeah, every single time they often go back to the first point of call. They could have died 2 days later and they'll pull the triage nurse for giving them a CAT 3 instead of a 2. So seen in half an hour instead of 10 minutes. So it's often the most stressful place to work because of that diagnosis of that patient or giving them a category. And then they want to know the observations.
Yeah.
They want to know the treatment. And they'll want to know if there's anything that sort of, they need to know from an alert point of view for the background medical history. Not everything about every medical history, just the important points. And I think triage nurses are happy if you guys say, we've gone down the STEMI pathway or we've gone down the APO pathway. That they're not unhappy with that. That actually helps them. Yep.
Absolutely. That's really good. And that's a really good point as well. To sort of understand, I guess, like when you start to begin to understand what other people's roles are and sort of break down what, say, the triage nurse difference is to the bedside nurse, to the resus sort of team, I think you'd be able to build sort of that knowledge and that understanding. It helps with that interprofessional communication and that relationship and that respect that you have for one another as well.
Yeah, and we don't want to keep, like, we know that there's ambulance, so every ED has ambulance offload times. So they get into the ED and you guys should be offload, like, half, they need to offload ambulances so you guys can get out and do your job. And some people, I think that, like, we're trying to keep you there in ED. That's not the case. Does that make sense? We don't want to keep you sitting in an ambulance bay for 5 hours.
Oh, absolutely. Because when you categorize them, say if they're a CAT, two and they need to be seen within 10 minutes, if they're a CAT 2 and still sitting on the ramp, which would be really bad, but it can happen, then, half an hour goes by on the ramp, they've not met that sort of neat target, that time that they need to be seen by a first clinician, like a nurse at least.
Yeah. And you know what? The hard thing is that I think too, like, there's patients that are not visible to you guys in terms of, like, out in our acute waiting room or out in our, reception or down in pediatrics or even in acute. And so that job of the num is also to go, well, I know you've got ambulances there that might be a CAT 3 or even a CAT 2, but I've got a CAT 2 who's in rapid AF at 145, who's in fast track, or even yesterday a DKA who's got a horrible pH of 7 that I've got to move from fast track, which is not appropriate to have a patient down there, into a resus bay, which blocks then acute, and that blocks your bed ambo being offloaded. So I think that's something to realize as well, that it is a team. But I do think that also you have to have a bit of thick skin. You got to realize that like, similar to like maybe a paramedic that's been on road for 10 years, a triage nurse can be a little bit tough. They sometimes can be abrupt, but they generally, if you get to know them, they're generally a wealth of knowledge. That's something to sort of, and I think for new paramedics, it's always helpful to practice handing over to these people. Don't be afraid of them, because you shouldn't be afraid of anyone that you work with. They should be people that are, I've got your back. Yep.
Absolutely. And two, when you're thinking about patient safety anyway, like, you're advocating for that patient, just do your hand over the way that, and take on that feedback of, what do I need to do better next time? But,
yeah,
taking away that fear of, no, this isn't about me. Like, take that ego out. It's not about me. It's just about this patient that's in front of me. I think it's a good sort of, I guess, attitude to take into it as well. Particularly students, I've been a student and I've handed over, and some handover has been absolutely shocking when I've been at a triage, window, because I've forgotten what I want to say, or something comes up and I'm like, oh crap, I don't know the answer to that. or, anything. So, or at 2 a.m. where I just completely blanked one night, and I was like, halfway through my handover, just stopped.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh damn, what happened? it happens.
It does, hey. And patients aren't always forthcoming with information. Like, not every patient goes, hey, I've got chest pain. It started 2 days ago. It radiates through to my back. Yeah, I've got associated shortness of breath. No, they don't. Or 15 days ago, I was walking down the street. So that's why it's really important that you guys get that story. And we'll get it as well. And sometimes your transport to ED has only been short. So, sometimes you don't get that time. And I think you've got to give yourself a bit of grace that, like, patients will tell you one thing and tell us another thing. Mm-hmm. And we can only go from what we've heard from you and seen from the patient. And then we make an assessment, and we can be wrong too. I've been wrong multiple times. Even had patients that have said, "I just feel super, super crap. I just feel so bad." I'm like, "What's wrong with you? I can't work it out. Couldn't work out. Repeat his blood pressure again, and it was like 70. Like he had a reasonably normal blood pressure initially, but it was just, I just got that vibe of like, something's not right. Try again. Can you just wait a bit longer? I'll come back. I just can't work out what's going on." And I think that's okay.
Absolutely. Our patients don't read the text, but a lot of people will be like, "Oh, they're a poor historian because they can't answer the questions I want." But I think it becomes really tactful in the way that you need to try and elicit the information that you actually need from someone, like changing your questions. It's happened so many times, particularly when I've worked sort of in day surgery. You ask people their medications all the time before they go into ED. Theatre. And you ask them, you go, because one of the questions is, do you have high blood pressure? And they're like, "No, not at all." And then you look at their medication list and you're like, "What about this?" And they go, "Oh, that's because I'm treated for it, but it's all okay." Changing, like, and then that for me was like, okay, I need to change my question to not, "Do you have high blood pressure or are you treated for high blood pressure? Like, do you take any medications for your blood pressure?" And then that way they're like, "Oh yeah, like I definitely take this blood pressure medication, this one and this one." And it's a bit more of a layman's term, sort of less jargon, I guess. And you're eliciting information in a better way, or a way in which you can actually get something from them.
Yeah. And I think too, like you raised a really good point too, then, just like about eliciting information from patients. And sometimes, like, I know it's hard at the moment because we're pretty stressed in terms of our job, but I think for new paramedics and student paramedics, being professional is a really good quality. And when you come to that triage nurse or whoever, keeping that professionality is really awesome. I think I get, off stretcher, do whatever you want. You got to have fun. You got to laugh. You got to make jokes. You've got to be human. Okay. And the patient can't lose the human side. Patients will say the funniest things on stretcher that I've heard, and they're epic. I love people, but it's always important to remember that they can hear everything when they're sitting on that ambulance bay. The paramedics that are super professional that will, pull you aside and maybe go, "Oh, I've got something to say," and they'll come away maybe from the patient. That's awesome too. I think it's also good to remember that you then have to repeat a handover sometimes to resus or to the bedside. That can be flipping draining for you guys because you've already done a handover and you're like, "Why am I doing this again?" And so then you shorten your handover. You may cut some things out and you may miss some important features. If it's a big resus, then you don't do the triage there. You do the triage in the resus bay. And that's awesome because you can do one big handover. And I can give some tips maybe for even clinicians that work in hospital to avoid a bit of confusion when it comes to handover. Yep.
Absolutely. And you bring up a really good point because when I was working in acute, for example, the best handovers that I thought, or the handovers I thought were the best or really helpful, were just ones that were really structured. That didn't go on for too long, but were able to give a story of what actually was happening for this patient and then provide like all the rest of their information, like their treatments or the obs and everything, in a succinct way. But things that were just structured was, and everyone does it differently. I don't think I've ever heard the same handover, done by the same person even. Like, it just changes for every patient that you have in terms of what's presented in front of you. But definitely having sort of a structure really does help. And the more information sort of you're able to give that's relevant really does sort of make a difference to what then I guess I did as a grad nurse in ED, like my assessments, etc. Before you said another nurse or another, like the triage nurse will go out and actually assess a patient, for example, it's all, and you say, we trust you, but it's I love the quote by, I think it was Tash Adams, who's a paramedic, and she said, "Trust but verify."
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really great great quote to use, but just something to remember going forth. Like, if someone's doing something, it's not because they don't trust you. Like, they want to find that information out for themselves as well and verify what's going on in their own head in terms of what's happening to the patient.
100%. And that's a beautiful point to raise, because I think people can get offended. Like, they can be offended. And I've had the same. Like, I've had, like, oh, I don't know, it could be troubleshooting a line. It could be, like, coming to look at a patient and them saying, this patient's really sick, can you come and look at them? And they go, they need to move. And I'll go, oh, do you mind if I have a look at them? And they're like, well, don't you trust me? It's like, no, I do trust you, but I want to look at the patient for myself, because I'm making a clinical assessment of the patient and I'm writing my name to every patient that I triage. And I think that's beautiful, is to leave that ego at the door and go, that's their job. Same as when you walk into a house and you're the treating paramedic, your job is to treat the patient and to look at them and to, you know, even ask the relative, do you mind if you move aside so I can assess them? You know, they shouldn't be offended by that. And so I think you're right. Like, you might say that the legs are shortened and rotated for an off. That's great, but I also want to look at it and see, is it a pubic rami fracture? Is it an ischemic leg? Is it anything else that I'm thinking of? You've got chest pain, or are they having aortic dissection? You know, is there anything that else that I think in my clinical judgment from my years of working and training that would change what I do? Because there are, and I'll give you an example, like even an old person that's fallen that may be on thinners or that's hit their face. It's like, well, do they need a CT of their head? Do they need a CT neck? Do they need a facial bone scan? Because if we order them all at once, it's beneficial for the patient for their journey. If I leave one out and they get a CT, 7 hours later, they're going to go to the ward. Someone scrolls through the CT and finds a C2 fracture. It's not good for the patient at all. It's bad for them in terms of their morbidity, mortality, and all that other stuff. So I really think that's important to let the triage nurse do their assessment. And they're not trusting you, that they're trying to just make, you know, verify, like you said. I think that's a great point.
Absolutely. And so I guess then I was thinking potentially we go into a little bit about what sort of the journey is for some of the most common patients. I guess we could start off with, say, I'd say start off with stroke, for example. I'm trying to think of neurology. I'm trying to think head to toe anyway.
Yeah,
but so a stroke patient. So an ambulance is brought in, a stroke patient or a query stroke patient.
Yep.
Sort of they've done everything that they can, you know, drive fast, make sure they've done a proper, like activated the appropriate teams,
yes,
and done what they need to do. What happens then generally, because yep, I know it'll differ policy to, you know, policy at yep different hospitals, but what happens then to that patient when they're in sure ED?
Yeah. So I guess if it's a true stroke, and what I mean by a true stroke, we've got our face, you know, speech or time symptoms, which you guys all know about. And within that 4.5 hour window is one thing that we look at. But at the moment, that's been extended. So anyone showing stroke symptoms up to 24 hours can actually get thrombolysis or clot retrieval, depending on your state and where you are. For us, we have clot retrieval at a few big tertiary centers. And we do, and your place, your facility hopefully would thrombolize stroke if they think it is. Thrombolysis for stroke is a very touchy topic if you look at the literature. However, neurologists believe that thrombolysis for stroke is the way to go if they're thinking it's a stroke. So I guess the patient would come in, and I'm assuming if it's a big stroke, then they may go into the resuscitation bays. And your triage nurse would obviously activate a stroke call. And that would basically let the team know either a stroke CNC, a clinical nurse consultant, and a neurology registrar and an intern would be notified in hours in some places. Out of hours, it can be a different story. It also notifies the radiology department, because you need to actually get a CT of the neck, an angio runoff and a circle Willis for the brain, and also a non-con CT, because stroke symptoms can also look like a bleed. So that's really important. Are they having a stroke? Are they having a bleed in the brain? Or are they having a stroke of the neck, big arteries of the neck? Because if you block here, it's going to block here. So that's just another thing to raise. And I guess as a paramedic too, just identifying where you think that, you know, where the weakness is, where the speech is happening, and when it happened. The hardest thing is the wake-up strokes. When were they last seen? Did they get up and do a wee? Did their wife talk to them in the middle of the night? You know, just trying to ascertain a bit more information about that stuff. Sometimes we don't know. And we can get a bit stuck on that. And then it is urgent for stroke, and time is brain, same as the heart, time is muscle. And so the main thing is just getting that succinct handover. If you can get access pre-hospitally, that's epic, especially if a big cube is always good, because our CTs can do a 22, but a 20 at minimum cannula in the cube is really good for the CT contrast, because you do IV contrast for the brain. And then from there, they would be rushed around to the CT scan. And we generally do a quick assessment on them. It's called neurology, we do a NIS score. It basically gives them a score on a stroke scale to see where they fit on the stroke scale. And the first thing they do is run around, have those lines in, CT them, and see if they've got any bleed on a non-con, and then go to a perfusion scan. Hopefully that makes a bit of sense. Hopefully I'm not talking crap.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, and then when they come back, if they see a stroke on a perfusion scan, we would use thrombolysis agents, such as TPA, which we generally would 0.9 per kilo, and then a 0.1 as a bolus. So 10% of that is a bolus, but push dose and then an infusion over an hour. And then the patient would generally be, if it's for clot retrieval, if it's just for that thrombolysis, they may stay in your center. But if it's for clot retrieval, they may send them to another center. And then we try to monitor blood pressure, because often in strokes, blood pressure can push up really high. And so, yeah, we give medications to, you know, reduce blood pressure, such as labetalol or hydralazine. You know, we don't want them to, you know, cone. We don't want them to sort of shoot off anything. But it's important, like you guys said, just the time, that handover that I missed, looking out for stroke symptoms. And if it's I guess the other thing is we can also look at sometimes Bell's palsy. So a seventh cranial nerve palsy or any of those sort of Bell palsy things can show up. But the triage nurse doesn't want to make that call at triage. There's things you can do to check that. However, we'll probably just call it a stroke, activate a stroke call. And if they're in acute, you can activate a stroke call in acute as well. So I think it's important to notify that, you know, patients can have strokes and they can go into the acute areas and you can activate a stroke call there. But it's important to use those terms that you think it could be a stroke. It's important because patients can present with a range of different problems as well. So assessing their speech, their arm strength is really important, when it happened, and do they have any dysphagia or any swallowing issues as well.
Yeah, sweet. All right. Well, that's interesting because I think the main point here in terms of what we're trying to do is just kind of give a bit of indication to paramedics. You may not understand what happens to a patient at ED. So, having those tests is really important because then you can just tell the patient, look, you're gonna, if they're able to obviously understand what you're saying, but, you know, you're going to go into ED, you're probably going to have a lot of people around you, you're going to go in for some scans, you're going to get lots of assessments done, and if it is, say, for example, this part of a stroke, you'll get treated with medications. If it's this and it's appropriate, they may go and do a surgery or a removal of whatever's there. Yep. And just being able to provide that for people and just sort of letting them know the next steps is kind of gives them the ability to have less stress, I guess. I mean, if I was in that situation, knowing what was coming next would make it a lot less stressful, in my opinion.
Correct. Yeah, and it's hard for the patient, especially if you can think of even speech changes. So you get a 40-year-old who can't speak properly with a suspected stroke. That's really stressful. I've worked on a stroke ward before, and the just sheer frustration on not being able to articulate words or say things or it is so stressful for the patient. And also we can have TIAs as well. I didn't put that in the mix, but we can have, TIAs in there, which can be just a mini stroke that resolves itself. And by the time you bring them to ED, it could have resolved or it could resolve on the beds. And it's important to just mention that as well. But let the patient know what's happening. And I always say, I don't give them concretes, but I tell them what potentially could happen. So you're more than likely going to be heading into a CT scan to look at the brain. And we're looking to see if there's any bleeding on the brain or is there anything blocking any of the major vessels in the brain. I tell the patient everything. I'm a big patient. I talk to them all the time. I tell them everything.
Well, I think it's the best part. And like even for we'll move on to things like, for example, your chest pains. You'd be like, this is incredibly stressful because every time, say, someone who doesn't have any sort of understanding of healthcare in general, like isn't in the healthcare world, doesn't have anyone around them that is, all they hear is chest pain, oh my God, heart attack, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
And so that, it can be incredibly stressful as it would be. Yeah. And not sort of, if you're sitting in ED or, ramped on the ambulance bed for a while and you're like, oh my God, what's happening? Like, am I going to die? What's going to happen next? And I think, keeping people updated with little snippets of information to the best of what you know, like if you go, I don't know what's happened, what's going to happen next. The doctors are still figuring out what sort of tests they want to run, but you know, we will keep looking after you. You know, just like certain little, just continue little, little check-ins, I guess.
100%. It's almost like you're, it sounds weird, but like you're feeding little bits of bread along the journey. So by the end of the day, they've got a full bun, you know, and they fully get the pieces all together. And you can, I always ask, do they have any questions? And I re-clarify things, because often sometimes physicians or specialists will come and tell them things like, what just happened? Good example. I had an aortic dissection the other night. This lady was super sick. And she goes, what the hell's going on? And I'm like, basically your vessel has layers, like an onion. Onions have layers. One of your layers has popped off. There's blood running in there. We're super concerned. It's called a dissection. It's dissecting. I drew a little picture while she's lying in the bed, recess bed. She loved it. She told her daughter on the phone, this is what's going on. Basically, I've got layers like onions. One of those layers is, you know, it was awesome. Like she just, that's how she remembered it. That's how I taught her. But it reassured her that we're trying to do everything we can to help her. Chest pain. There's, I guess one thing to know for paramedics is there were some big changes with chest pain over the last 10 years. One of them came out of a patient who basically died in a waiting room with chest pain, a young person. And in some centers, we do get a lot of patients that can have pathology and be young with chest pain. So I've seen MIs with 21-year-olds. So you can have young people that have, you know, that ischemic attack with that are young. Triage nurses, if it's true sounding chest pain, we'll give them a category two. It's just part of our policies to give patients that have chest pain a cat two. So it's really important to identify, do they have chest pain at triage? It's some question that should be asked. Now, I mean, like, I'll just give you that blanket rule. There are patients that have chest pain that it's not ischemic sounding. It's worse, deep on inspiration. It sounds pleuritic, and they could get a category three, those patients, from the triage nurse. But it all depends on that triage nurse and their confidence in the chest pain and where it comes from. It's also very important to remember that women with chest pain do present quite differently, and they can have epigastric pain. I've had patients with no chest pain that are having huge STEMIs. So even if you did were on stretcher and you got an epigastric pain coming in as a female, I would, or even just anyone that's got undifferentiated, a 12 lead wouldn't go astray if you're a clinician. That's just my opinion. I also think if you're not trained to interpret ECGs, then reading about it is really helpful, or getting someone to show you, and just picking out the big things on a STEMI, which you guys would all do in your training. I've had STEMI sitting in the ambo bay and just people that weren't sure if it's a STEMI, and they're looking at it going, whoa, I've ran in and they've gone to cath lab in 5 minutes. And it's not a knock on the clinician at all. It was a, you know, but that's taken me a lot of time to learn that sort of stuff. And generally with chest pain, you know, all that PQRST with pain is really important. The triage nurse would generally want them on a monitored area, because most of the time patients that get chest pain, what are we looking out for? It's a STEMI or a non-STEMI is our big thing with chest pain, or our aortic dissections or something crazy, AAA. But, and then what we're looking for is it ST segment elevation on an ECG, or do we have an elevated troponin? I guess for everyone out there that doesn't know much about bloods, troponin is just an indicator of myocardial damage. There are things that can affect troponin levels. Renal impairment can affect it if they've had any previous surgery on the heart, which is important to ask the patient, and those sort of things. Over 14 is generally the higher end of normal for troponins. And then generally sometimes we do them the moment they come into ED, and then 2 hours post that, or 2 hours or 4 hours post the pain, and we compare the two. So for you guys, you'd hand over about chest pain, where it is, have they got any cardiac history or any other family history? Drugs are really important, so you can get cocaine-induced cardiomyopathy, HOCM, or anything related to early death with cardiac stuff. And then obviously assessing the patient, is it still there? Have you given any treatment for the patient? Aspirin, GTN. I guess always be mindful of those inferior STEMIs. But all of you guys would know there's policies out there now for STEMI pathways. And we have like a bat phone that you would call if you actually have a true STEMI. And at the moment, I'm not sure in Brizzy, but in Sydney, you may even bypass the ED to go straight to a cath lab.
Yeah.
Which I'm a big advocate for. If you've got a lab, you've got a known STEMI, they call the cardiologist, interventional cardio, on call. Hey, I've got a 45-year-old, got a STEMI inferior or whatever. And you can just go straight through, like Macca's drive through, straight through the ED. You might just say hello, head in, get your stent, and you're feeling good. And there's the evidence trial, which is running around at the moment for anyone that's getting the Lucas put on with CPR. They can go straight to a cath lab as well with the Lucas on and almost bypass the ED as well. That's running big tertiary centers at the moment. So that's chest pain. Yeah. And also other things like shortness of breath related to it. I mean, your COVID stuff, but we all know about that sort of stuff. But yeah.
Awesome. I think that's a great run through. And yeah, particularly like things that we obviously don't do in the pre-hospital, which is bloods, troponins, go get a chest x-ray, see if there's any sort of underlying pathology there. They may go get an EST or an exercise stress test. But you're so right. I've had patients before who have been young. They've about to go for their stress test and we're like, oh, they'll be fine. And then they come back, they've had a positive stress test. And then you have the person who's, you know, ticks every cardiac box there is, and they come back with a negative stress test. And you go, how does that work? Like, you can't pick it. So, yeah, definitely important to be on the lookout for those types of things. The last one, I guess, I want to kick off with is, I guess, abdo pain. But I mean,
abdo pain.
That is such an undifferentiated, unspecified. There's so much. And I think
it's good. It's good. It's a good one, actually. Abdo pain. Yeah.
Yeah. What that sort of journey is for that patient, like what sort of tests they're going to get, just really brief in general, just so that our paramedics know.
I love to put a caveat out here, and I sound a bit random, but young females with abdominal pain, please don't box them, put them in a box. That's the biggest thing I find in ED is that we put a young female in, and it shouldn't be young females, but it tends to happen with an undifferentiated abdo pain. And we just sort of say, oh, it's just, you know, whatever. But I just want to put that as a caveat. Even if the patient has had previous abdominal presentations, with abdominal pain, please don't put them in a box. Like, please see what you see at the time and just, you know, identify what you're looking at. I guess abdominal pain is crazy. There's multiple organs in the abdomen. Ones we get really concerned about that can be injured as any trauma to the abdomen, which you guys all know. But any abdo pain, will leave trauma aside because we'd be worried about spleen, liver, or any organs in the tummy. But things that could potentially be concerning is, where is the abdominal pain? I always ask. So which quadrant is it in? Because which quadrant can identify what organ or what thing could be wrong with it? If it's sitting in the, you know, right lower quadrant, obviously we know it could be appendicitis. You know, is it sitting up the top? Could it be related to your liver? On the left side, could it be related to your spleen? And there are things that we should be thinking about when it comes to your patient. Things that I always want to know about abdo pain is, when did they wee last? Or is there any, you know, dysuria? When were their bowels open last? I mean, the questions that you should be asking your patient. And does anything relieve the pain or make it better or worse? You probably should feel your patient's tummy as a clinician. And if you haven't done an abdominal assessment as a paramedic, maybe it's a good thing to just watch a few videos and see how to do it. You're just looking to see, is there pain in a quadrant? And what does the tummy feel like? Things that really concern us are masses. Things that really concern us are really, you know, overlying guarding, or when they're like, oh, don't do that, or tenderness. And those are things that really get us concerned. Other types of things, so that's just abdominal pain, things that are associated with it, like vomiting. So things like bowel obstructions really concern us, or any previous abdominal pathology. So someone that's had a previous bowel obstruction that's vomiting and has abdominal pain, I get really concerned with. Anyone that's sort of got, you know, a new onset or sudden onset of something that's excruciating, we get concerned with as well. Other things with abdominal pain is with women is like last menstrual period. And could it be related to the reproductive organs? So, you know, ovarian torsions are out there. Are they pregnant? So, pardon me, you know, ask them the question, is there any possibility you could be pregnant? Those things are really important to ask your patient. And is there any, you know, any bleeding or any discharge? I think you've got to be really professional and ask those questions. In terms of males as well, same again, do they have any pain in their testicles? So things we get concerned about are simple, like a torsion, testicular torsion. The testes can tort, especially in kids, and you've got to be careful with kids because they're too scared to say that their pain's actually in their testicle, and they'll say they've got abdominal pain. And that's a surgical emergency, and they need to be looked at. You can lose your testicle if it's not sent to theatre urgently. And the same with pregnancy as well. Also check if they're pregnant, because if they're over 20 weeks pregnant and they've got abdominal pain, they probably should go up to a birthing center or a delivery suite. And the other thing with abdominal pain is, you know, as I said before, could they just be in urinary retention? I know it seems really silly, but like, I've had people in abdos distended. I've done an assessment, I'm like, what's going on here? Do a bladder scan, they've got like, you know, 1,000 mils in their bladder. I'm like, bros. The other thing with abdominal pain is, obviously, as I said, by assessment of the pain, I mean, you can listen to bowel sounds if you want to, but ask when their bowels last open. Sometimes it's hard in an ambulance where they're moving or percussing the abdomen can be a little bit hard to do, but just feeling the abdomen could be just enough to sort of get it. Flank pain, you know, thinking about, do they have any sort of like kidney stones. There's things that we get worried about. And give your patient pain relief. Like I'm not the pain relief, like the you know, I don't count how much endo my hospital uses or how much morphine my hospital uses. I don't really care. But if my patient has pain, I treat them with analgesia. And I'm mindful that if they're reporting that their pain's 10 out of 10, I know if they're on their phone and doing other things. I use my clinical judgment, but I'll do a full set of observations and give them analgesia. And sometimes anti-nausea meds are really helpful too if they've got associated nausea. But that's just sort of me with abdomen pain. They come in, they get triaged. Depending if it's really concerning, they may get a CAT2 if the pain's excruciating. If not, generally abdo pains, if they've got a pinpoint tenderness, they'll get probably generally Category 3. Mind you, if observations are crazily out of the flags, then they're going to get those CAT2s. And CAT3 means they've got to be seen within half an hour. Those patients generally get bloods. They get a urine test or a beta HCG, or and they'll generally get maybe liver enzyme tests, LFTs, lipase, if they're thinking about that sort of stuff, or any markers like their bilirubin or something like that. And they're more than likely, then if they're older, they might get a CT scan, depending on their creatinine level or how bad their kidneys are functioning. They may get an ultrasound if they're a female. Sometimes we don't want to always radiate people with CTs. And so they may get a like an ultrasound looking for an appendix if they're a kid as well, or if it's a torsion, an ultrasound. And the other thing is, as I said before, urine. And they may get a surgical review by a surgeon to come down and have a look at their tummy. Elderly patients with abdo pain, it can be anything. So that's really important to know. And they generally might be an acute if they're an elderly patient with abdominal pain. I've had STEMIs in 80-year-olds that have got abdo pain, perfed bowels, just anything. So just really important to, that's important to know about abdo pains. And then from there, it's about getting their pain under control, assessing that, seeing if you need any surgical intervention, ruling out the big, you know, bleeding in the abdo, ruling out all the big ones that you guys would know, excluding all the big, huge pathologies, and then going to, you know, what could it possibly be? Is it just a UTI? Is it an STI? Is it just a renal stone? Or do they have, you know, a perfed appendix? Yep. And then from there, they'd go to a specialty. If it's an appendix, they're going to go to theatre. If it's just abdo pain, they may stay in hospital for a bit of time. Or it could just be some diverticulitis. They may just get some IV antibiotics. And blood cultures, if they're febrile, always check if they're febrile.
Yeah, sweet. You know, ask your, when you're at, you know, hospital, ask the nurse what tests will you do, or things like that. Just like starting to get an understanding of what can actually, well, what you're going to actually do for that patient, and what their journey may look like. Just so you have a bit more information for the next patient, you know?
Yeah. And follow up. Like I regularly, like, believe it or not, this might sound a bit crazy to people, but I regularly tell paramedics what happens with the patient they brought in regularly. Like I literally will say, hey, Fee, Fiona, or hey, whatever, you know, the guy you brought in before, he's got this. And they love it. They go, oh, can you show me the scan? I think the biggest thing sometimes nurses can make, or doctors, is that they can treat paramedics like they're para, as in on the side, you know, and not part of that team. That's BS, bro. I'm so against it. Like, you know, I regularly say, like, you know, and sometimes the nurses don't understand that. They don't see what you do, because they just see you walk into the hospital, bring a patient in and sit at the ambulance bay, hand over and walk out. Like, they don't know that you've been under the car, or that you've gone down and got this person that needed fire brigade, or that you had a domestic with police and you got this person who was handcuffed, swearing, and you got punched on the way out. They don't get that. So I think it's a really big thing to feed back to paramedics and tell them that. They love it. I regularly get, I would say every shift, a paramedic said to me, oh, Benny, you know the guy I brought in yesterday, do you mind just seeing what happened to him? But always. And I think that's being kind, and it's the continuity of care. And I think that's important, is that you listen to the paramedic, and then you treat them like they are a professional, and you take that, you know, like I said before, yeah, you still do your own assessment, but you do have that professional courtesy. And like last week, I got pretty upset. There was a, you know, patient came in, and everyone was rushing around, chatting, grabbing things, not listening. And I just said at the end, I'm really sorry. Like, that shouldn't have happened. They should have listened. They didn't. I'm sorry. I came in halfway through it. And you know, that was just my feedback, and I apologized. And I said, I'm sorry, we'll try and do it better next time. And I think paramedics want to be informed. That's my opinion. I could be wrong, but that's just what, that's the vibe I get, eh?
Nah, that's awesome. Well, I really thank you for, you know, sharing all your knowledge today. It's been absolutely fun chatting to you. I was just going to say, what is your final, I guess, thing you wanted to finish off on, or your tips for students, both nursing or paramedic students?
This sounds really silly, but I think sometimes people will say to me, like, what does it mean to be successful? And I always say, doing what you want to do every day. And I think that's important, is if you're doing what you want to do every day, then you're successful. I think we want to, you know, have the knowledge, or have had the experience, or I've been to that thoracotomy, I've been to that MBA, I've done this. But if you're just doing what you love, I think that's important. And the other thing is, like, be kind to yourself as a human. Like, if you're a student paramedic, you're learning. So don't expect, like, expect that you want to learn more. So don't give up. Don't, like, settle for nothing. Ask questions, be curious. I love that sort of statement, being curious. The other thing is, listen sometimes. Like, that listening's huge. I'm learning more to shut up and listen more. And you can learn so much from just listening. I used to say this, and this is probably random and it sounds really wrong, but I say, be a leech. So leech the good information, not the bad stuff. Leeches generally get blood, the good stuff. It's got hemoglobin, it's got platelets, it's got it's got that good stuff. So leech the good stuff, man. Leech the good stuff, the people that bring you joy, the people that have that information, the people that you trust. It's sometimes the quiet person. It's sometimes that quiet paramedic that hasn't said too much on their shift. And you go over to them and say, oh, hey, I just want to know, have you ever seen this before? Oh, yeah, I have. Oh, what did you see? And they'll tell you, like, what the hell? How did I never know I worked with this person? Just because I wasn't curious. I was so focused on me and not looking at the person I was working with. That's just me. And, yeah, that's just sort of something that that's my opinion.
Awesome. I love it. Well, thank you so much for jumping on today. I implore everyone to go and listen to the ED Jam podcast. It's absolutely fantastic. And yeah, just a fantastic resource. So thank you so much for sharing your time, Benny.
Thanks, legend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.